19. The new Iberian ambassador was an incredibly tall and thin man, standing well over 190 centimetres. He was aged around 40, and had thick black hair slicked back from his face with a scented pomade. His skin was swarthy, and he had a large, hooked nose set between prominent cheekbones. His eyes were dark, almost black, Maddie thought, and his eyebrows were thick and bushy. They, too, were black, with no trace of grey in them. She wondered if he perhaps dyed his hair. He wore a richly brocaded red and gold tunic, with the national symbol of Iberian, a griffin, on the left breast. He was accompanied by a retinue of only 4 attendants, since he had been warned that the official dinner was to be a small affair only. "My apologies again for such a small gathering, Don and Salvo," Cassandra said, as they were all seated at the dining table in the large hall. "Normally, I would have arranged a larger group to welcome you, but, as you know, my husband and our Ranger Corps Commandant are absent at the moment, so it's just us." Just us was Cassandra herself, Maddie, Diamond, and Lord Anthony, the Castle Araluen Chamberlain. Don and Salvo waved the apology aside. "A smaller gathering gives us the opportunity to get to know each other more closely," he said. "And besides, who could complain about a gathering that contains 2 such beautiful ladies?" He made a graceful hand gesture that encompassed Cassandra and Maddie, at the same time contriving to bow forward from the waist, in spite of the fact that he was seated. Maddie caught Diamond's eye and rolled her own eyes. Diamond hid a grin behind his napkin. Iberians, Maddie had been told, were well known for their effusive compliments and exaggerated sense of gallantry. Don and Salvo looked at her now, his perfect white teeth showing in a smile, and she bowed her head toward him in recognition of his remark. "You're too kind, Don and Salvo," Cassandra said. He looked back at her.
"Tell me, my lady, what is it that has taken Sir Horace away from the castle?"
He had been informed of Horace's absence when he arrived, but the reason hadn't been stated. Cassandra shrugged. "It's a relatively minor matter, but one that requires his attention." Don and Salvo tilted his head to one side.
"A relatively minor matter?" he repeated. "What is it, exactly?"
Cassandra wasn't keen to discuss Araluen's internal politics with the new ambassador. Araluen and Iberion were at peace, but the Kingdom of Iberion had a reputation for meddling when other countries were having problems. She indicated for Diamond to answer, feigning disinterest in the matter.
"A small group of hotheads and rabble-rousers are trying to stir up the people," he said. "It's not a big problem, but Sir Horace thought it best to stamp it out before it became one."
Don and Salvo nodded, leaning back in his chair while he considered the answer.
"And he is right," he said. "Any sign of rebellion must be stamped out quickly. We have a problem of our own in Iberian."
"And what might that be, Don and Salvo?" Maddie asked. She sensed her mother's reluctance to discuss the Red Fox clan, and thought this was a way to steer the conversation away from them. Don and Salvo favoured her with a rather patronising smile.
"It's nothing that need worry such a gem of female pulchritude," he said smoothly.
She smiled back, forcing the expression onto her face. "And yet, I'd be interested to know," she said. He shrugged.
"As Sir Diamond says, hotheads and rabble-rousers, 2 of our southern provinces are seeking to secede from Iberion and form a separate nation. Naturally, we can't allow this to happen."
"Naturally," Maddie said dryly. She was willing to bet that the provinces in question were rich in farmland or natural resources. Don Ansalvo studied her briefly. He didn't seem to notice the cynical attitude behind her reply. But then, Maddie thought, he was a diplomat and had years of experience in masking his true feelings. She shifted slightly in her seat. In spite of her misgivings about wearing formal clothes once more, Maddie was enjoying the dinner. The blue gown that her mother had chosen for her was an excellent choice, and she knew it suited her. But it was a fraction tight around the shoulders. Don Ansalvo took a sip of his wine and turned his attention back to Diamond. Maddie had the distinct impression that he preferred to discuss important matters with a man, rather than with a girl like herself, or even her mother, the Princess Regent. "But tell me, Sir Diamond, what is the nature of this rebellion of yours?" he asked. Diamond hesitated. He seemed to share Cassandra's reluctance to discuss internal politics with an outsider. But Don Ansalvo had been frank and forthcoming about the problems Iberian was facing. So it was difficult for Diamond not to go into a little detail. He glanced quickly at Cassandra, who nodded almost imperceptibly. "There's a small group of agitators who object to the law that says a daughter may inherit the throne. They wish to return to the rule of male succession," he said. His tone indicated that he would give no further details on the matter. The ambassador nodded slowly. "Ah, of course. Your country is one of the few that allow female succession, isn't it?" he said thoughtfully. "You say they wish to return to the old way. So this has not always been the law in Araluin?" "My grandfather changed the law," Cassandra told him, with a note of finality in her voice. Don Ansalvo stroked his waxed moustache. "It would never do in Iberion," he said. "My people wouldn't stand for it." "If they're anything like you, I'm sure they wouldn't," Maddie thought. She glanced quickly at Diamond and was surprised to see the stony, set expression on his face. It was there for only an instant, and then he realized she was watching him, and smiled brightly at her. She assumed his look of distaste was triggered by the Iberian's unmistakably superior attitude to all things Araluin. Cassandra interrupted Maddie's train of thought with her next question. "So, Don Ansalvo, when do you plan to move into your residence?" As ambassador, Don Ansalvo was provided with a large manor house as his official residence. It was a few kilometres south of the village that sheltered under the castle's protective shadow. Cassandra's question, and the deliberate change of subject, indicated to him that any further questions about the trouble in the north would be unwelcome, and probably go unanswered. He was diplomatic enough to concede. "I thought we would leave at mid-morning tomorrow," he said, "if that suits your arrangements." "As a matter of fact, that would suit me perfectly," she said. "We're about to let most of the castle staff go and keep only a skeleton staff on duty." Don Ansalvo's raised eyebrows posed an obvious question, and Lord Anthony leaned forward to explain. "At this time of year, the farms in the district are ploughing the stubble into the fields and gathering food and firewood for the winter, salting meat and bringing in the late harvest of vegetables," he said. "Most of the castle staff come from local farms. We usually let go as many people as we can spare to help out, and this year, with Sir Horace and most of the garrison absent, we only need a skeleton staff in the castle. No more than 20 people. Even I will be leaving early tomorrow. My daughter and her new baby are coming to visit and staying at our house in the village." Anthony smiled at Cassandra. "The princess has kindly given me leave to spend time with them." Of course, Don Ansalvo replied. Then he turned those dark, penetrating eyes on Maddie once more. But what will you do, Princess? Won't it be boring for a lively young woman like yourself to be stuck in a half-empty castle?
Oh, no, Maddie replied, with expertly feigned enthusiasm. I'll have my sewing and needlework to keep me busy and entertained. You've no idea how diverting petit point can be.
Don Ansalvo sniffed delicately.
I'm sure I haven't, he replied.
Maddie quickly glanced at her mother and read the warning expression in her eyes.
Don't push it.
But Maddie was still irritated by the ambassador's earlier comment about Araluen's laws of succession. She smiled sweetly now. Tell me, Don Ansalvo, you said a female ruler would never be accepted in Iberion. What makes you say that? The Iberian leaned back in his chair and made a languid gesture with one hand.
Iberians, believe it is not a woman's place to rule. That is a man's role.
Maddie saw the quick warning glance from her mother, but ignored it. With the smile still fixed to her face, she continued.
And what, precisely, is a woman's role?
It's an important one, the ambassador said condescendingly. A woman nurtures and teaches. She is the emotional center of the home. She creates an atmosphere of gentility and affection, so important for the family.
And stays barefoot in the kitchen?
There was a hard edge to Maddie's voice now. But Don Ansalvo didn't seem to notice. He considered her statement and nodded.
We have nothing against shoes, but preparing meals is an important part of a woman's function, either cooking them herself or overseeing the efforts of servants.
He nodded toward Cassandra as he said this. Then, seeing Maddie's obvious disagreement, he continued.
But a woman cannot lead a country in time of war. That is a man's job. No woman has ever done so.
My mother has been involved in more than one battle in her time, Maddie said doggedly. The smile was long gone now. Cassandra made a gesture for her to desist, but Maddie had the bit between her teeth. And Don Ansalvo's reply had only served to fan her anger further.
Yes, he said. Before I accepted this appointment, I studied your mother's past accomplishments, and they are admirable. But the battles she fought in were small skirmishes, not full-scale wars.
He bowed toward Cassandra.
No offense intended, my lady.
I think the Temujai invasion of Scandia might count as a full-scale war. I'm sure the Scandians thought so, Maddie said. He raised an eyebrow at her in polite disdain.
And was your mother in command of the Scandian army? He asked.
She flushed, realizing she had trapped herself with her hasty words.
Well, no, not exactly.
As I read the account, the commander was the Scandian Oberjarl Ragnac, and his chief strategist was one of your rangers.
That's true, but...
In fact, in all of her battles, Princess Cassandra was assisted by one or more of your redoubtable rangers, and her husband, of course, a champion knight. Fighting and commanding armies is not something a woman is cut out for.
Yet my mother is practicing with the sword, Maddie said.
Don Ansalvo tilted his head to one side, considering the statement.
Ah, yes. Many Iberian ladies of noble birth learn to use the foil or the épée. It develops coordination and balance. But I think a woman with a light sword, facing a fully armored knight, would be at some risk. Don't you agree, Sir Diamond?
Daimon, not expecting to be drawn into the conversation, hesitated awkwardly. He had no wish to offend the ambassador, or Cassandra.
"I think," he said reluctantly, "that in such a case, the advantage would lie with the man."
Don and Salvo nodded, a superior expression on his face. Cassandra hurried to change the subject before Maddie could speak again. "Well, that's enough talk of wars and fighting," she said. "Don and Salvo, I'm told you are an expert performer on the lute."
The ambassador bowed slightly from the waist. "I do have some small skill in that area."
"Then perhaps you'd favour us with a song," Cassandra said. Don and Salvo shook his head modestly, making a disclaiming gesture with both hands.
"No, no, I couldn't possibly bore you," he began.
But one of his entourage had already produced a lute case from beneath the table, and was opening it and passing it to his master.
"Oh, well," said Don and Salvo, accepting the instrument. "Perhaps one song, an Iberian song about a beautiful lady and a noble knight who dies defending her honour."
"And more fool him," Maddie thought grimly. She settled back in her chair, her anger at the smooth-talking, condescending Iberian still smouldering. Don and Salvo smiled at her with what he thought was overwhelming charm, struck a few preparatory chords and began to sing. Maddie leaned back in her chair. "This could be a long night," she thought.
20. The following day, Maddie and Cassandra were strolling around the battlements, enjoying the expansive views below the castle. Cassandra was taking a welcome break from her desk and its litter of paperwork. "Well, you managed to survive the ordeal of dining with the Iberian ambassador," Cassandra said. Maddie frowned.
"He's a pompous, condescending git," she said spitefully. Her mother smiled. "Such courtly language," she said.
"He seemed very taken with you."
"He seemed very taken with himself," Maddie replied. "But he certainly kept himself busy, passing oily compliments on my unsurpassed beauty." When he had finally set the lute aside, after not one but half a dozen numbers, Don and Salvo had spent the rest of the evening plying Maddie with effusive, overstated compliments, all of them based on his appreciation of her physical charms. "Well, he's a diplomat and an Iberian. There's an old saying, when you've learned to fake sincerity, you're ready to become an Iberian diplomat." Maddie pushed out her bottom lip in a moo of mock disappointment.
"You mean he wasn't being sincere?"
Cassandra grinned. "I'm afraid not. In case you were wondering, your eyes don't really shine to match the full moon low over the horizon," she said, quoting one of Don Ansalvo's more exotic compliments.
"I'm devastated to hear it," Maddie said, in a tone that indicated she was anything but.
"I felt sorry for Daimon. He was sort of caught in the middle there, wasn't he?"
"Yes.
He apologized later for not sticking up for you. But there wasn't a lot he could say. You seem to be getting on well with him," Cassandra added, a questioning note in her voice. Maddie nodded.
"Yes, I like him. He's good company."
"You know he's a distant relative, don't you?" her mother said. "Daimon?" Maddie looked up in surprise. Cassandra nodded.
"Pretty distant. I think he's your cousin 6 or 7 times removed on your grandmother's side," she said.
"It gets a little hard to keep track after 4 or 5 removes."
"So we're related."
"No wonder he's such a nice person," Maddie said. It's not a close enough relationship to form any barrier if you were interested in him, Cassandra said, studying her daughter's reaction. Maddie snorted derisively. Oh, please, she said. I like him. He's good company. But I'm not interested in him romantically. Cassandra shrugged. Just saying, if you were, she said. It was a new experience for her to think about her daughter forming attachments with personable young men. She wasn't totally sure how she felt about the sensation. But Maddie waved the idea aside and changed the subject. So what's been keeping you busy? Cassandra sighed and stretched. I'd forgotten the amount of paperwork involved in accepting a new ambassador, she said. King Carlos of Iberian sent a 20-page missive for me to answer in detail, and in suitably florid court language. I should have kept Lord Anthony on for a few more days to draft the reply for me. It's taking me ages. Why not call him back? Maddie asked, although she suspected her mother would never do that. Cassandra shrugged. His daughter arrived with her new baby daughter. He's settled happily at home with his family. And with the visitors, he has a lot of work to do stockpiling food and firewood for the colder months. What about you? What have you been up to? She asked. Maddie waved a hand vaguely in the air. Oh, just poking around the castle. I've been out to Warwick and Lou's farm a couple of times to see Bumper. Patrolled the area to see if anything's happening. Gillen asked me to do that, she added, in case her mother might think she was interfering where she wasn't wanted. Cassandra nodded. She knew about the arrangement with Warwick and Lou, knew they were part of Gillen's intelligence network, and she was aware that Gillen had asked her daughter to keep an eye on the fief in his absence. Gillen said something about the old abbey above the farm, Cassandra said. Yes. Apparently, they had seen lights up there, or thought they had. I checked it out, but there's been nobody there for some time. If anything, it was probably travellers passing through and using the building for shelter. She paused, then changed the subject abruptly. Mum, tell me about the South Tower. Castle Araluen had four towers, one at each of the four corners of the crenellated outer wall. In the centre was a fifth, the keep. The main administration offices, formal dining halls, audience rooms, throne room, and apartments were there, along with floors of accommodation for visiting guests and senior castle staff. Cassandra's and Horace's workspaces were there as well, in addition to the royal apartments. The keep was lower than the four towers, but it was joined to them at the fourth floor level by four arched stone walkways, which gave the entire structure the appearance of being ready to spring into the air. You grew up here, don't you know? Cassandra replied. Maddie shook her head. I never spent much time there when I was a kid, she said. But I was in there today, and it seems kind of empty. There are no rooms or apartments, well, hardly any, in the lower floors. It just seems sort of superfluous. Maybe that's why it never interested me when I was growing up. I suppose not, Cassandra replied. Actually, it's what we call our retreat of last resort. That phrase caught Maddie's attention, Cassandra thought, seeing her daughter sit up straighter. It had implications of adventure and action, and as such, it would inevitably fire her daughter's interest in martial affairs. That sounds fascinating, Maddie said. Cassandra elaborated. In the event that Castle Araluen's outer wall were breached, she said, we would fall back to the keep as our penultimate line of defence. But if that fell in its turn, the defenders could access the South Tower by way of the arched stone bridge. The South Tower is much more defensible and is set up to survive a long siege. How so? Maddie asked. The top levels are served by a single spiral staircase, which could be easily defended by a few men. It's the only access. Not quite, thought Maddie, but she said nothing. Cassandra continued. The upper two floors are kept stocked with food and weapons, and within the spire there's a large cistern that collects rainwater. That would be even more important than food supplies in the long run. Even a small force could hold out there for months. Maddie nodded thoughtfully. Cassandra mistook her expression for concern and added reassuringly, "Not that it's ever likely to come to that, of course. The outer wall has never been breached." "Of course," Maddie said. "That explains why it's the only tower served by a secret staircase," she thought. If all else failed, the occupants could escape down to the cellar level and out through the tunnel under the moat. Cassandra rose from the table. "Well, I'm afraid I still have work to do," she said. Maddie looked up at her. "Don't stay up too late." Cassandra smiled. "I'm supposed to say that to you," she said. She started toward the door that led to her office. Then, as a thought struck her, turned back. "Oh, by the way, don't disappear tomorrow. I have people arriving that I want you to meet." Maddie grinned at her. "Not more smooth-talking Iberians." Cassandra gave a short laugh. "Not these people. They're quite rough and ready." "Rough and ready?" Maddie replied. "They sound like my sort of people." "They are. I'm pretty sure you like them. They're Scandians." 21. The eight archers broke ranks and ran for the riverbank, where horsemen were waiting to help them across the ford. Handing their bows up to the riders to keep them clear of the river, they seized hold of the horses' harnesses, grabbing stirrup leathers or girth straps. Some of the horses had leather harnesses around their necks as well, and these made excellent handholds. The riders waited until their passengers were settled, then urged their horses forward at a walk into the river. Seeing that his men had started crossing, Gillen paced backward to the riverbank, keeping a keen eye on the foxes. As he'd expected, their discipline and their willingness to fight had evaporated. They skulked among the trees, seeking protection from the deadly arrows, even though they were well out of range. Their commander, his left arm in a sling and a blood-stained bandage around his shoulder, railed at them in vain, challenging their courage, threatening to withhold their pay and have every fifth man whipped. They avoided his furious gaze, turning away and sinking to the long grass, physically and mentally exhausted by the ordeal they had just gone through. Reflecting the opinion of the sergeant, who had led them back to safety, they occasionally cast angry glances at their shouting commander. "It's fine for you to shout and threaten," they thought. "You stayed safe here in the trees while we were providing target practice for those cursed archers." A leader who refused to share the discomforts of campaigning and the risk of combat with his men rapidly lost their respect and their willingness to obey his orders. But their commander was too obtuse to realize that. He thought bluster and threats could take the place of respect. Eventually, by dint of threatening and punishing those who disobeyed, discipline would be restored among the foxes, to a certain extent. But it would take time, and in that time, the enemy were escaping across the ford. Gillen waited on the southern bank, keeping a keen watch on the enemy force, until the second group of archers were almost across the river. Then, seeing no sign that the foxes had rallied, he turned Blaze's head and urged the mare into the river. She pushed strongly, half walking, half swimming. She wasn't as long in the leg as the taller cavalry horses, and the water came up almost to the saddle. But Gillen was an expert rider, and he maintained his balance against Blazer's lunging progress, staying in the saddle as the horse forced her way across the ford. Then he felt the water level dropping away as the river shallowed. Blazer's gait steadied, and she trotted up the bank, pausing to shake herself, sending a shower of water that gleamed silver in the sunlight. Horace, who had been waiting for Gillen, took the brunt of it.
"Thank you very much," he said sarcastically, wiping river water from his face.
Gillen grinned easily at him.
"If you don't know, that's the first thing a horse does after it's been swimming. Don't blame me."
Horace shielded his eyes with one hand and peered back across the river. No sign of movement there. Gillen stood in his stirrups and followed the tall warrior's gaze.
"It'll be a while before they get them moving again," he said. "They've taken 2 droppings from our archers, and they won't be keen for a third.
Of course, things might change once they see we've moved out," Horace said. Gillen considered the statement.
"You think they'll keep after us then?"
Horace nodded. "Don't see why they wouldn't. They lured us here for a purpose, and so far they haven't accomplished it." Gillen scanned the ground around them. The terrain here was similar to the side they had just left, with relatively open ground for 100 meters or so, then thick trees. 40 meters from the river, he saw a line of low bushes, 15 meters long and about chest high, that would provide concealment for a small group of men.
"I'll keep 4 men here, under cover," he said, indicating the bushes.
"Once the foxes get their nerve up and try to cross, we'll do what we can to change their minds."
"And what happens when you leave?" Horace asked.
Gillen shrugged.
"With any luck, they won't know that we've gone. I'll get the men to fall back one at a time, staying low until they reach the trees. If you leave some horses tethered there for us, we should get a head start on them."
Horace considered the plan. "That should work," he said. "Without horses, they're going to have to try to get ropes across the river, so that their main body can cross. So the first men to cross will have to swim, carrying the ropes."
"And they should be easy targets," Gillen agreed. "If we pick off 3 or 4 of them, the rest will be reluctant to try crossing. By the time they realize we're gone, we should have a good lead."
"I assume you'll be the last to leave," Horace said. Gillen met his gaze evenly.
"Of course," he said. "I'm not going to ask someone else to stay behind. Besides, I'm the best shot, so it makes sense for me to stay till the end."
"Just checking," Horace said mildly. In Gillen's place, he would have done the same. Besides, as the ranger said, it made sense for the best shot to be the last to leave.
"You'd better get moving," Gillen told him now in a brisker tone.
He gestured toward the far bank and the small figures moving among the trees.
"They won't stay moping around over there forever."
He dismounted and strode quickly to where the archers were waiting. Most of them had stripped off their soaked outer clothing and were working in pairs to wring the water out. They looked up as he approached.
"All right. Get dressed and move out. Find the horses you were riding and mount up. Nestor, Cleet, Gilbert and Walt, you stay with me. Have you all got full quivers?"
2 of the men nodded. The others indicated their quivers. One had 3 shafts left. The other had 5.
"Right. Collect more from the supply wagon. In fact, get extra for the rest of the men. On the double," he snapped,
and the 2 archers trotted off to the supply wagon, where 2,000 spare shafts were stored in arrow bags. A few minutes later, Horace led the force into the tree line and turned to the west. Horses for the four archers, who would remain with Gillen, were tethered in the trees, out of sight of the far bank. Horace led Blaze into the trees and let the reins fall to the ground, once they were in the shadows. The ranger horse would wait there until Gillen came for her, staying low to avoid being seen. He then returned to the line of bushes, where the others were waiting. They crouched in the cover of the bushes while he outlined the plan. "Stay out of sight," he told them. "We don't want them to know we're here until we start shooting. Then, one by one, make your way to the trees and follow the main party. Try to stay out of sight. I want the enemy to think we're still here, even after we're long gone." The four men nodded. They grinned at one another. They were enjoying this fight. Usually, a battle meant they stayed in a line and shot shaft after shaft into the air in a solid hail of arrows. It was fairly impersonal, and most of the time they couldn't really see the effect their shooting was having. This encounter was different. They had seen their shafts taking down the men who were advancing on them, seen the havoc and uncertainty their shooting caused. And so far, they had been untouched themselves. "Might as well make yourselves comfortable while we're waiting," Gillen told them. "I'll keep an eye on our friends across the river." They settled down on the soft grass. Like all soldiers, they were experienced in taking any opportunity to rest. In the space of a few minutes, two of them were even snoring gently, their heads resting on their packs. Gillen looked at them and smiled. Nesta, the oldest of the group, saw the look.
"They'll sleep anywhere," he said, grinning. "If they'd stopped halfway across the river, they probably would have dozed off there."
The sun was warm on their backs, and their clothes were quickly drying. Not that they'd be completely dry, of course, but they were no longer heavy and sodden. Gillen pulled his cowl up to put the pale oval of his face in shadow, and crouched behind the line of bushes, finding a gap through which he could watch the far bank. A mayfly buzzed around his head. He was tempted to swipe at it, but resisted the urge. The movement might be seen by the enemy. Instead, as it hovered close to his face, he screwed his lips up and tried to blow it away. The mayfly ignored the attempt. Time passed, and the faint noises of Horace's group, the jingle of harness, rattle of weapons, and thudding of hooves on the soft grass, gradually died away. The mayfly became more persistent. And in spite of himself, Gillen found his eyelids drooping heavily. He shook his head and changed his position into a less comfortable one, kneeling on one knee. Cleet and Walt continued to snore softly. He saw movement across the river and came more upright, looking closely, although remaining concealed behind the bushes. A dozen or so men were advancing from the tree line, heading for the riverbank. They moved cautiously, expecting any minute to be assailed by a hail of arrows. As this didn't happen, they became more confident. Initially moving in a crouch, they stood and began to move faster. Gillen, from his hiding place, could see that three of them had heavy coils of rope around their shoulders. He nodded to Nesta, indicating the two sleeping men. The old archer reached behind him and shook the two men gently. Experienced warriors that they were, they came awake without any undue noise, instantly ready for action. "They're coming," Gillen whispered. "Get ready." The four archers slowly changed position until they were kneeling on one knee behind the covering bushes. They had each slipped an arrow from their quivers and had them ready on the bowstrings. They looked expectantly at the ranger, now half concealed in the bushes, where he had moved forward for a better view. "Not yet," he said softly. The three men carrying the ropes had reached the river's edge. They shrugged the rope coils off their shoulders and began to attach the loose ends to anchor points on the bank, sturdy saplings or deeply embedded rocks. They stripped down to their undergarments and tied the ropes around their waists. "They're going to swim the ropes across," Gillen whispered. "We'll wait till they're halfway across and start shooting." Watched by their comrades, who were crouched behind their shields on the bank, the three rope carriers waded into the river. One of them cried out in surprise as he felt the unexpected strength of the current. Then he recovered and continued to wade out. Within a few meters, they were shoulder deep in the water and forced to begin swimming. As soon as their feet left the bottom, they began to drift quickly downstream. But they were all strong swimmers, and Gillen could see they were making good progress across the ford. He selected the first man who had entered the water. He was obviously the strongest swimmer of the three, and had gained a lead of several meters over the others. "I'll take the nearest one," Gillen said, rising slowly to his feet. "You take care of the others." His four archers also rose, their heads and shoulders now above the screening bushes. But they went unnoticed. Understandably, the men on the far bank were watching the swimmers, slowly paying out the rope behind them as they fought their way across the river. The fact that they had been unmolested so far had given them a false sense of confidence. Gillen brought up his bow and sighted on the leading swimmer. Beside him, he sensed the other shooters were doing the same. "Now," he said softly, and released. 22. Maddie rode out early the next morning on Sundancer, heading for Warwick's farm. Mindful of Cassandra's instructions not to disappear, she had checked with her mother and ascertained that her Scandian guests wouldn't be arriving before midday. "But that means you have to be back here by 11:30, her mother warned her. "I want to ride down to the dock to welcome them." Maddie promised that she would be back well before that time, and went to saddle her horse. She rode through the portcullis and across the drawbridge, nodding a friendly greeting to the sentries there, who came to attention to salute her. Once she was in the parkland, she set Sundancer to a gentle canter, enjoying the wind in her hair as the Eridan loped across the neatly tailored grass, his hoofbeats sounding a dull tattoo on the soft ground. When she entered the forest, she had to slow down to a trot. The trees grew too close together here to permit any higher speed, unless in the case of a dire emergency. She whistled as she rode, and Sundancer, sensing her cheerful mood, tossed his head and shook his mane at her. She leaned forward and patted his neck. He was a good horse. But her mood was caused by the fact that she would be seeing Bumper. She hadn't visited the farm in several days, and she was missing her shaggy little companion. "If it weren't for him, you'd be my favourite horse," she said, and Sundancer tossed his head once more at the sound of her voice. Unlike Bumper, however, he didn't reply. Warwick was working in the barn when she rode into the farmyard. He had the big doors open to admit light, and was repairing the leather traces on a plough. He strolled out to meet her as she dismounted, and then tethered Sundancer to the post by the farmhouse door. "Morning, Maddie," he said cheerfully. "Come to see Bumper, have you?" "That's right, Warwick. And you, of course," she added with a grin, which he matched. She had her ranger cloak rolled up and tied behind her saddle. She took it down now, shook it out, and swung it around her shoulders. The simple act of wearing it made her feel more positive, more confident. The cloak was a symbol of who she was and what she did. "Thought I'd scout around the area," she said. "Has anything been going on?" Warwick screwed up his face thoughtfully before answering.
"Not sure," he said. "Barnaby Codling at Codling Farm says he thought there'd been people up at the Abbey again the other night. But Barnaby's inclined to imagine things. Once he hears there's been activity there, he's bound to think he's seen it. Likes a bit of drama, does Barnaby."
"Maybe I should take a look," Maddie said. She had loosened the girth straps on Sundancer's saddle and was heading for the barn to saddle Bumper. "Can you feed and water Sundancer for me?" she asked. Warwick nodded.
"Be pleased to," he said.
He had set down his tools and moved to where the Aridan was standing patiently. He rubbed the velvet nose. Sundancer snuffled and nuzzled his jacket, searching for the apple that was always there for a hungry horse. Warwick chuckled and fed it to him. In the barn, Bumper nickered a welcome to Maddie, his ears pricked and his eyes alert, as he put his head over the half-door to his stall. She fetched his saddle and bridle from their pegs and lifted the saddle up over his back.
"Where have you been?" he demanded.
He became quite touchy if Maddie left him to his own devices for too long. She patted his neck, then swung up into the saddle. "I've been busy," she said softly. "I'll tell you about it when we're out of here."
"Well, that's all very well, but I've been worried about you. Never know what might happen to you if I'm not around."
"Sundancer would look after me," she said, and Bumper snorted loudly, rattling his mane at her.
"Sundancer? That overbred excuse for a horse? What could he do if you got into trouble?"
"Sundancer has excellent bloodlines," she told him. But he was unimpressed.
"All thoroughbreds tend to be hysterical and far too excitable for their own good, or for yours."
Ranger horses, of course, were bred from many different bloodlines. The core horse breeders selected horses for their differing qualities. Some for speed, some for stamina, some for intelligence, and bred the best of those qualities into the shaggy little horses they provided to the core. As a result, horses like Bumper, who was nothing if not outspoken, tended to be somewhat snobbish about the merits, or otherwise, of thoroughbreds. Maddie sighed. No wonder some people call horses nags. Bumper jerked his head up and lapsed into silence. She smiled to herself. She'd finally got the best of him in a verbal duel, she thought. And she'd been saving that quip for some time now, looking for a chance to use it.
"Talking to someone?" Warwick asked as they emerged into the sunlight.
She shook her head. "Just myself. Bad habit I've gotten into." Warwick nodded understandingly.
"First sign of madness," he said cheerfully.
He had a shrewd idea that rangers talked to their horses. He'd heard Gillen do it several times. But it would never do to let on that he knew, of course. "I'll take a look around up at the Abbey," she said. He waved a cheerful farewell to her as she urged Bumper into a trot and headed out of the farmyard into the surrounding forest. They were halfway to the Abbey before Bumper relented and spoke to her again. He was a garrulous little horse, and he couldn't stand to be silent for too long, even if he was pretending to be offended.
"What do you expect to find up here?" he asked, as they negotiated the steep track that led to the Abbey.
"Probably nothing," she admitted. Warwick didn't place too much faith in the reports that there'd been people up here. The ground around the Abbey, a two-story stone building with a bell tower at one end, had been cleared of trees, leaving an open space roughly 50 by 30 meters. The wind was stronger up here on the hilltop, and the treetops bent and waved in the breeze. There were several pines among them, and the wind created that strange surf-like sound that pines make as the wind passes through their branches. She twitched the reins lightly, and Bumper came to a stop. She surveyed the area. It seemed unchanged since the last time she had been here. "No sign of anything," she said. The ground was hard and rocky, and she knew it had rained the previous night. That, and the constant wind, would remove any faint trace of tracks that might have been here. Any sign of activity would likely be inside the building. She swung down from the saddle, grunting slightly at the ever-present twinge in her hip, as her feet touched the ground and took her weight. "Stay here," she told the horse. He pricked his ears, but said nothing. Even though she didn't expect trouble, she had been trained to always be ready for it. She took her bow from the leather bow case fastened behind Bumper's saddle, unclipped her quiver from the saddle bow, and clipped it onto her belt. The bow and quiver stayed out at the farm with Bumper. A relatively powerful recurve bow and a quiver full of arrows fitted with warheads might create unwanted curiosity around Castle Araluin. She knocked an arrow to the string and advanced toward the abbey. The double doors were closed, although the left-hand one showed a gap of several centimetres between it and its neighbour. She tried to remember if it had been unlocked on her previous visit, but couldn't. "Some ranger you are," she muttered to herself. It was her constant expression of self-criticism. She stretched her left leg out, placed her foot against the slightly open door, and shoved hard. There was a loud creak from the rusty hinges as the door swung farther open. The stiffness of the rust in the hinges stopped it before it slammed back against the door frame, but it left an opening big enough for her to pass through. She waited, listening for any sound of movement inside. Her heart rate was up, and her breathing came a little faster. To enter the abbey, she'd have to expose herself in the doorway, silhouetted by the outside light. She'd be a perfect target for anyone inside. If there were anyone inside. Moving quickly and silently, she slipped through the opening, stepping immediately to her right to clear the doorway, filling the opening for only a second or two before she slipped into the concealing shadows inside the old building. Nothing moved, except for a few dry leaves that stirred in the open doorway, swirling around as the wind blew in. Gradually, her eyes became accustomed to the dimness, and she searched the interior, ready for any sign of danger. But there was nothing. The abbey was a large single room, with a small choir gallery against the rear wall. The bell tower rose above this gallery. A rickety old wooden ladder provided access to the gallery, which stood 3 meters above the floor of the main room. The high-arched ceiling provided the extra height required to accommodate it. There was a window set in each of the walls beside it. The door was set midway along one of the long side walls, so she could see both the gallery and the altar and pulpit. Several rows of pews were still standing in the church, but at least half of them had been taken by local inhabitants over the years. They were made of good quality timber, and there was no sense leaving it here to rot. She guessed that if she inspected the farmhouses in the area, she'd find where the old pews had been converted to household furniture. Settles, chairs, bedsteads, and the like. The door creaked softly as a stronger-than-usual gust of wind moved it a few more inches on its stiff hinges. She realized she'd been holding her breath and let it out now in a long sigh. She lowered the bow and released the tension she'd held on the string. Then she saw the fox face. At first sight, It appeared to be nothing more than random scratch marks in the hard-packed earth floor. But then she realized that the marks formed a definite shape. It was upside down from her viewpoint. But as she moved closer, she made it out for what it was, a rough outline of a fox's mask. It was on the floor between two of the surviving pews, and she guessed that it must have been scratched onto the hard earth with the point of a stick or a metal spike of some sort. Possibly the artist had been sitting on the pew idly passing the time, amusing himself while he waited for the meeting, if that was what had transpired here, to begin. One thing was sure. It hadn't been here on her previous visit. "So," she said thoughtfully, "it looks as if something has been going on here after all." She searched the rest of the floor and found no further sign of activity. But a fox's face scratched into the earth was a good indication of who had been here. It was too big a coincidence to be anyone other than the Red Fox clan. And as Will was fond of telling her, "We don't believe in coincidence." Satisfied that there were no further clues to what had been going on, she retraced her steps to the door, pulling it closed behind her as she went out, leaving it as she had found it when she arrived. Bumper raised his head curiously.
"Find anything?"
"Yes. It seems that Barnaby Codling wasn't imagining things," she told him. "We're going to have to come back here and keep an eye on the place." Bumper flicked his tail at an errant horsefly.
"Suits me."
Maddie stroked his neck idly as she considered her options. There was no way of knowing when the foxes might meet here again. That meant she would have to keep a constant watch on the abbey, and that would mean slipping out of the castle each night via the tunnel. "I'm going to have to move you closer to the castle," she said. "I'll find a spot for you where the forest begins." She could be spending hours on watch at the abbey, and the thought of walking each night to get here didn't appeal. And she could hardly ride Sundancer out and switch horses at the farm as she'd done today. She'd be seen leaving and arriving back. If people knew she was absent from the castle for hours each night, questions would be asked by her mother, among others. "And I don't have any answers for her yet," she admitted to herself. "Just a vague hunch that something underhanded is going on." She rode back to the farm, where Warwick had finished repairing the plough traces, and was now replacing a broken hinge on the home paddock gate. "Don't you ever have a day off?" she asked. He shook his head cheerfully.
"A farmer doesn't know what that means," he said. "Find anything up at the abbey?"
She told him about the fox face scratched into the floor. He rubbed his chin thoughtfully as she described it.
"I never noticed that before," he said. "Why would someone do that?"
She shrugged. "I guess to pass the time while they were waiting. Anyway, I'm going to be coming out here for the next few nights to keep watch. I'll find a spot for Bumper closer to the castle. Can you lend me a bucket and a horse blanket for him?" She looked at the sky, with white clouds driven by the gusting wind. The rain seemed to have passed. "And a sack of oats, if you have them," she added. Warwick nodded and strode into the barn to collect the items she needed. As he handed them to her, he asked,
"Want me to come with you to watch the abbey?"
She shook her head. "I'll be better alone. Two of us will be twice as easy to spot, and I'm used to staying out of sight." She swung up onto Bumper's back and, leaning down, unhitched Sundancer's reins from the post. "I'd better get back and meet those Scandians," she said. 23. Leading Sundancer behind her, she rode Bumper into the forest and headed at a brisk trot toward the castle. She had surveyed the land around the castle over the past few days, and had earmarked a spot where Bumper would